The Tom Woods Show, episode 1171.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, we hear a lot of anxiety these days about people's jobs. They're afraid of automation, robots taking their jobs. They're afraid of the pink slip. They're afraid that maybe a tweet is going to get them fired. Well, whatever the case may be, in the age of the internet, there's no excuse not to be starting on your side hustle that could someday be converted into your primary gig. I've got some step-by-step approaches for you in my free ebook over at PathsToIncome.com. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. We've got a great Bitcoin episode for you. And if you're inclined to say, I don't listen to Bitcoin episodes, well, you're wrong. Well, you might be right that you don't listen to Bitcoin episodes, but you're wrong not to listen, particularly today, because Saifedean Ammous is going to get you very, very interested in the subject. Here's somebody who understands economics inside and out. He's super duper great and sound and solid on that. And he also understands Bitcoin inside and out. And he's written a very, very interesting and important new book called The Bitcoin Standard, The Decentralized Alternative to Central Banking. He holds his PhD from Columbia University, where he is a member of the Center on Capitalism and Society. And he is a professor of economics at the Lebanese American University. Saif, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure.
This is quite a book, and I don't understand how it is that I was not familiar with you before, because you understand money as well as anybody, which is, you know, not something I find myself saying a whole lot. And then your material on Bitcoin, of course, is just great. I want to focus primarily on the Bitcoin angle, in large part because I feel like the people who listen to this show have heard a lot of episodes on money, especially if they've listened to the early episodes, and they're very well read in this area. But I think for at least a good chunk of us, Bitcoin is, if not brand new, still mysterious enough that it needs a bit more unpacking. So I'd like to really jump right into that part of the book, if I may, assuming that you're talking to an audience that gets the benefits that you're talking about, that understands what money is, the function, the roles that it plays, what you're looking for in a good money, what we should and should not fear in money. So, for example, if there's a limited supply of a money, this is not a bad thing. So-called price deflation is not a bad thing. You can assume you have an audience that's already with you on questions like that. So is it okay if we jump into the Bitcoin stuff?
Sure. I just want to say first, you may not be familiar with me, Tom, but I am very familiar with you. And I want to thank you so much for all the work that you have done. You were instrumental in educating me about economics over the last 10 years. I've followed your writings quite closely and I've learned so much from you. And it is a pleasure and an honor to be interviewed by you.
All right. Now I feel even worse. That's very kind of you to say. Now I feel terrible. All right.
No, not at all.
Of course, we want to get into the fundamentals. I'm dying to ask you about the Bitcoin Cash phenomenon because your opinions in here definitely place you in that debate on that continuum. And I really want to race ahead to that, but we can't do that yet. First, let's talk about Bitcoin. Every time I talk about Bitcoin, I ask somebody, explain it to me like I'm seven. In effect, I say the problem with Bitcoin that I see in terms of widespread adoption is that I get why techie people would like it, and I get why radical libertarians who want to take the time to figure it out would like it. But why would my grandmother like it?
Well, she doesn't really have to like it eventually. She's going to have to learn to use it, whether she likes it or not, is the way that I generally think of it. But don't worry too much about her because, it's still a very young technology, and eventually the user interfaces are going to improve to a point where it becomes very easy for people to use it in the same way that, you know, you and I use cars and airplanes and laptops, but we have no idea about how they work under the hood. So, you don't have to understand all of the mechanics of how Bitcoin works if you're going to be using it. And eventually, that's going to be really the case. And in my book, I do describe the mechanics, but I mainly focus on them in terms of their economics, just to explain the economics of the system. But I think, for any average user, they just need to know how it works, how they can utilize it. You know, you need to know how to drive the car. You don't need to know how the car is built and how the internal combustion engine works.
And by the way, that's an excellent point, because when I think about the things on which my life depends, without which I would not be able to do anything I do, it's shocking how little I know about how any of it works, right? Almost nothing. And yet I never stop to think, well, I can't use this refrigerator because I really don't understand the precise role that Freon plays in the cooling process. It doesn't occur to me to ask that question. I just go ahead and use the refrigerator. But the difference is, a refrigerator is just one part of my life. And if one refrigerator fails, okay, I replace it with another one. But Bitcoin, if I'm using it as money, or at the very least as a store of value, has much, much greater importance to me. And I feel like I better at least understand the basics if I'm going to put this much trust in it. You see what I mean?
Well, I mean, yes and no, because, you know, the alternative is far more opaque and far harder to understand. I mean, if you think Bitcoin is complicated, I'd like to introduce you to the Federal Reserve System, which is far more complicated. And, you know, at least the difference is that with Bitcoin, if you want to understand it, you know, all this code is open source. You can read it, you can review it, you can read what other people are saying about it, and you can discuss it openly. But good luck trying to do that with the sort of voodoo that is done behind closed doors with central banks.
I get that point. But on the other hand, I bet you 75% of Americans wouldn't know what you mean by open source. And that's something Bitcoin people pride themselves on. And yet most people don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but I mean, I make this point in my book that at the end of the day, you know, hard money is not really optional. This isn't a new app or a new iPhone that, you know, we need to market. And my book is not a marketing attempt. I'm not trying to get people to buy Bitcoin, because I think at the end, in the long run, it won't really matter. You know, for the same reason that countries by the end of the 20th century, you know, everybody in the world, by the end of the 19th century, everybody in the world was using gold as money, even though the vast majority of people didn't understand why it was gold that was chosen as money. But economic reality is compelling. And the reality is, you know, if you had seashells in the 19th century as money, you were in trouble, and people who used gold as money were able to inflate the supply of seashells in your economy by using their gold to buy boats, flooding the supply of seashells and then destroying the monetary role of seashells in your economy. So in the long run, the way that I see it is, you know, user interfaces are going to be improved. Entrepreneurs are going to deliver solutions that will make using Bitcoin as simple as using your fridge and as reliable as using your fridge. And we're already seeing some of these beginning to emerge. And, you know, the open source aspect of it is, I guess, like the Freon example that you gave. It's you don't have to understand it to figure out how the thing works.
All right. So in order for us to proceed, I do want to go on to chapter 9, which is called What is Bitcoin Good For? But before we do that, how would you define, let's say, not too techie and not too oversimplifying, how would you just simply define what Bitcoin is so we can then proceed?
Well, the definition that I use for Bitcoin is that it is a distributed software for operating a payment network with its own hard money as a currency. And I like that because it's a functional definition that doesn't get under the hood. It's a software, Bitcoin. Fundamentally, what it is, it's a software that operates over thousands or millions of computers all over the world, and it allows for you to transfer value from one computer to the other, or from one individual to the other, using a currency that is protected from inflation without trusting third parties. In other words, it's a form of hard money that doesn't rely on trust. It's hard cash. It's digital hard cash.
All right. So now let's go into what functions it serves that would be what people would be looking for in a good money. And the first of these that you list, and this is quite significant given ongoing controversy within what we might call the Bitcoin community. The first one you choose is not medium of exchange. The first one you choose is store of value. So a store of value just means that as with any, it doesn't have to be a money, by the way, to be a store of value, because diamonds are a store of value and I don't exchange them as money. So there are lots of different kinds of stores of value, but a store of value would be, in other words, something that I can have and be reasonably confident that it will maintain or even increase its value over time. That's not true of maybe antique furniture, maybe, but typical, you know, things like furniture or obviously perishable things like food. These things are not going to hold their value over time. And certainly government monies are not going to hold their value over time. So this is what we're talking about when we say store of value. Why is Bitcoin uniquely poised to be a particularly good store of value?
I make the argument in my book that it might just be the best store of value ever invented. And the reason is that it is the first liquid store of value that is strictly scarce. And I mean by that, it is scarce not in terms of it being expensive to produce like gold is. It's scarce in terms of its total supply being totally fixed, meaning that no matter how much effort we put into it, we can't make more of it. And I think this is a very important point that most people don't really get because primarily, you know, the environmental movement has spread a lot of hysteria recently. And people generally think that, you know, we're just on the verge of running out of oil or running out of zinc or copper or whatever, some essential metals that are going to bring our civilization to a halt. This sort of chicken little environmentalism has been around for about 40, 50 years. And it makes people think that we live in a world of scarcity, which is not true. Because if you think about it, you know, we've barely scratched the surface, and I mean that literally, of Earth in terms of looking at, in terms of finding resources. The amount of resources that exists on Earth is beyond our ability to even measure in any meaningful way. We've owned the biggest hole that anybody has dug anywhere, I think, is about 3 kilometers deep, whereas the diameter of the Earth is 12,000 kilometers. So we've hardly scratched the surface of the Earth in terms of looking for resources. The limit on how much we can have of any particular resource, whether it's oil or gold or diamonds or anything, is not their prevalence on Earth, because we can just keep digging and finding more. But what stops us from digging and finding more and, you know, taking out all the gold in the crust of the earth or all the nickel or all the oil is cost, is specifically the opportunity cost of doing so. In other words, oil is scarce not because the quantity of it that exists in the crust of the earth is limited in any meaningful way. It's scarce because we can only dig so much on any given day, because we're also digging for other things and we're using our time and labor for digging for other things. But if the price of oil goes up or if the price of zinc goes up, you know, the opportunity cost of it will decline in terms of other goods. And so we'll start producing more and more and more of it, and we'll start increasing the supplies. In other words, the limit on any resource that we produce is not how much it exists on Earth. That's a meaningless metric for us. The limit is how much we dig for it. And this is why, if you look at the proven reserves of any metal or oil, you see that as we consume more, we just keep getting more and more reserves, because we explore for more, we dig more, and then we find more wells, and now we have bigger reserves. So global oil reserves, and I have a chart of this in my book, global oil reserves today are much larger than what they were 20, 30, 40 years ago, even after 20, 30, 40 years of mass consumption. So things, everything else is scarce in terms of its, scarce because it involves human time to produce it. And that, to quote Julian Simon, is really the only resource that is scarce. It is the ultimate resource, as he calls it, because with human time, we can make more of anything. It's trivial for us to produce triple the quantity of oil that we're producing this year if we just dedicate more time towards oil production rather than any of the many other things that we do with our time. But Julian Simon said human time was the only thing that was scarce. But unfortunately, Julian Simon was not around with us, was not around to see Bitcoin emerge, because now we finally have one other thing that is truly and strictly scarce, like human time. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins, and that's not just because the computer code says there will only be 21 million Bitcoin. It is because Bitcoin is the only one of all of these other programmable coins, whose code is practically set in stone. And that's why it's the only one that matters, in my opinion. And that's why, you know, I'd really prefer if we don't waste our time discussing Bitcoin Cash or any of the other altcoins, because I believe they're completely and utterly inconsequential, because it's completely trivial for the people behind them to change the money supply behind them, which makes them uninteresting. But Bitcoin, as we've seen, people have struggled so hard over the past few years to try to change things in Bitcoin. And to the delight of people like me, they have failed miserably at it. And so they've been unable to change things as simple as the block size. So you can be quite sure that they won't be able to change the supply of Bitcoin. In fact, if they do change it, all that will happen is that they'll create a new coin. So this reliable scarcity of Bitcoin, the fact that its supply is so fixed, in my opinion, makes it a natural match as a store of value because, you know, your time is the one thing that's scarce on Earth. And if you're trying to, the reason you want money is to store the value that you produce with your time. So you work for a day today and you make $100 and you don't want to spend them all. You'd like to save them for next year. Think of the store of value as being a machine that transports your value of your labor from today until next year. And the ability of other people to increase the supply of that machine, to increase the supply of the store of value that you're using, you can think of it as an inefficiency in that machine. It's like the inefficiency of an engine, of a car engine. So all car engines are inefficient in some way. There's never been a 100% efficient car engine. They all involve losses of energy in terms of heat and noise and so on. So it's almost inevitable that with any store of value, you're going to get some loss in the value that you store in it over time because others will produce more of that store of value and thus they will be able to take some of the value that you stored in it by increasing the supply. So in other words, if you store your money in the Venezuelan Bolivar today, the Venezuelan government will keep printing more and more of their supply, and that'll take the value out of the money that you're holding. They get to expropriate the value of your labor without them having to produce anything of value. And so that's what makes the Bolivar a very lousy store of value. So for me, the ability to increase the supply of a store of value is the most undesirable feature of it. It's the biggest inefficiency of it. And Bitcoin is the best solution that I think we as human beings have ever come up with this. That's it. There's only ever going to be 21 million. So if you have one Bitcoin today, you have one over 21 million over the entire supply of Bitcoin that will ever exist. And 100 years from now, it'll still be one out of 21 million of all the Bitcoins that will ever exist. And that, for me, I think will naturally just make it gain a role as a store of value. As we've been seeing for the past 9 years, people are storing more and more wealth in it, and its price continues to rise.
All right. Let me ask you, though, just for the sake of argument here, I do want to push back a little bit. I understand your position, but the folks with Bitcoin Cash are arguing that the initial promise of Bitcoin was not simply that it would be a store of value, but that it would be a medium of exchange and that people would use it in ordinary transactions. Now, that aspect of Bitcoin seems to be breaking down, and you get two different responses. One is, well, we're coming up with some innovations that may help foster that again. And the other one is, we never really needed the medium of exchange function anyway. It's best to think of Bitcoin as being digital gold, and it's fine for it to be expensive to transact in. I think at the very least, the Bitcoin Cash people can say that their concerns are concerns that are rooted in the original vision of Bitcoin and that vision is being changed in ways that aren't radical enough. In other words, if you really want to challenge the Federal Reserve, you've got to challenge it not just by introducing another store of value, you've got to introduce another medium of exchange. And if Bitcoin is now going to yield that field, then, isn't that a shame? Explain to me why I'm wrong about this.
It's absolutely wrong because, first of all, the Bitcoin Cash people, they fundamentally confuse the idea of the method of payment or the payment of system with the function of medium of exchange. So the point of what makes a medium of exchange is that fact that people will exchange it with one another. And once something is desirable as a store of value, people will want to be paid in it. People will want to use it as a medium of exchange, and then it will get used as that. Now, the payment mechanisms in which it is delivered is a separate issue. Okay, so the platform on which the payments are made is something completely different from that. In other words, the dollar is a medium of exchange. PayPal is a payment system. And this confusion of the idea that PayPal is the Bitcoin Cash, people seem to think that, you know, PayPal is the medium of exchange and we need to build Bitcoin into a bigger PayPal that's a medium of exchange. But that's not true, and that's not important. Also, you know, Bitcoin is not a religion. It is not a cult. Satoshi Nakamoto is not God, and he's not a prophet that has given us holy scriptures that we must preserve. This is a technology that has evolved over time. And, you know, I don't like to get into all of this ideas about what Satoshi wrote and what he meant and what he really meant. Satoshi is just a human being like you and me. If he had something to say about what's happening with Bitcoin, he's perfectly capable of making his own opinions felt and telling people what he wants. But he introduced this technology and it's going to grow. And I'm sure you understand the concept of spontaneous order, that, you know, things that involve human action, they're not the product of human design. So yeah, he produced the initial design, but what Bitcoin has grown into is not something that he necessarily foresaw, not something that he had to foresee. It's the product of people using it in the market and people understanding what it's good for and people using it to its advantages. And jokingly, I like to use the example of Viagra. You know, initially, the original vision of the people who made Viagra was that it was going to treat baldness, I think, or heart disease or something like that. Turned out to be much better for, you know, other uses. And you don't see people going around angrily demanding that Viagra get used for treating baldness. Maybe it does work for other things. In any case, I don't even believe that this is really true of Satoshi's vision. And the Bitcoin Cash people can be really annoying in the way that they spread this silly idea. But more importantly is, you know, forgetting about all of the religious scriptures and looking into it. Thinking of the important questions that you said, if you want to disrupt the Federal Reserve, what do you want? This is exactly what Bitcoin matters for, in my opinion, which is that, you know, we don't need a new PayPal. If we do invent a new PayPal, you know, we shave off 50% or 90% of PayPal fees, that doesn't really make a big difference. That doesn't really excite me. That's something that some startup could do one day and, you know, great for them. They'll make a few billion dollars and it'll be a great thing. But who cares? You know, we could still have a cheaper, more efficient PayPal run with an inefficient, with an easy form of money like the US dollar. What matters is what we need is a new form of central bank. We want to replace central banks. We want to be done and rid of central banks that allow us to that are able to control money. So for me, regardless of what Satoshi wanted, what really matters is that now we have this technology that can allow us to have the monetary policy of really hard money. A monetary policy that nobody can change. This, for me, is why Bitcoin matters. And so, just to begin with, you know, the entire notion that we're going to hard fork Bitcoin to increase the capacity is a complete non-starter for me, just because hard forking Bitcoin makes it trivial to then go into hard forks that will change the money supply. This is why it's a complete non-starter. Even if I agreed that I would have liked for Bitcoin to have the properties that the Bitcoin Cash people want, the fact that they need a hard fork to do it is why it will never happen and why it's a completely stupid idea. I'm sorry for saying that, but it's an extremely stupid idea. You know, the only thing that's valuable about this is nobody can mess with the money supply. If you're going to go and change that, so it's just so that you could double the transaction throughput or quadruple the transaction throughput or even multiply it by 100, that is one of the dumbest engineering trade-offs that anybody could ever do. Because even if you multiplied Bitcoin's on-chain capacity by 100, it would still not be enough to make all of the transactions of a small town in America, let alone the rest of the world, okay? Bitcoin currently does, what, 500,000 transactions a day or something like that. That's the capacity. So multiply that by 10 or 20 or 100 and increase the block size by 100. And what do you get? You still have a system that can't handle as much transactions as a small little town in the US. If you want a payment network that handles all the payments of everybody in the world, it's completely unimaginable that anybody would want that on the first layer of Bitcoin. Because, I mean, anybody who says that, anybody who thinks that, must not understand how Bitcoin actually works. Because, you know, the way that Bitcoin works, the way that Bitcoin transactions are confirmed, is that every single member of the network has a record of every single other member's entire transactions. And then based on that, you get to you are able to tell if I am paying you honestly or not. You know, every 10 minutes you get a new block, and the new block updates you and tells you, you know, Safe has 5 bitcoins. And then if I send you one, you see that I had 5 and that I sent you one, and then you check that I'm not spending anywhere else, and then it gets confirmed. I mean, it happens every 10 minutes. So imagine if you wanted to do this where it was all the world's payments were settled on Bitcoin, you'd have to have 7 billion accounts. And, you know, can you even make an estimate of how many transactions happen every day in the world? You know, you'd have maybe 100 billion transactions a day taking place every day. So you'd have to have 100 billion transactions on your own computer for you to know every single person, what they're doing and what they're selling and buying. And that's just absurd. It's impossible. It's impossible for you to follow this. Plus, it won't even be workable because you have to wait at least 10 minutes for one confirmation in order to not be in order to be sure that the transaction is not invalid. So, you know, if you wanted to use this as a way to pay for your lunch, Bitcoin on chain to pay for your lunch, you have to wait at least 10 minutes to get one confirmation. It's not safe to spend any transaction that doesn't have at least one confirmation, although I would recommend waiting for several confirmations, at least if there's a big account, if there's a big payment involved. So the notion that everybody in the world is going to be using the Bitcoin blockchain itself to pay for all of their payments is something that only people who are completely ignorant of how Bitcoin works from an engineering perspective could say. It's absolutely absurd. And frankly, I'm quite disappointed that we're wasting this episode discussing this idiotic idea rather than getting into some interesting economic discussions. This is really the problem with it. And, you know, it will never work on this level where we have 7 billion people running their own on-chain transactions and waiting 10 minutes for every single thing that they spend. Secondly, it doesn't have to, because what we need it for, we don't have a big problem with PayPal or Visa or MasterCard. Sure, you know, it would be great if we could reduce fraud on Visa and fees on credit cards and fees on PayPal and all of those things. But let's face it, that's not the biggest problem in the world. That's not the reason we get wars and inflationary governments. And that's not the problem that is, you know, allowing all these governments in the world to expropriate the wealth of their people and do all these horrible things with people's wealth. The problem we have is inflationary monetary policy. Bitcoin can solve that by, and this is the point that I try to communicate with my book, you even at its current level with only 500,000 transactions a day, which is about the maximum that Bitcoin has done so far, even at this level, Bitcoin is able to process enough transactions to have a settlement layer for a global settlement system for thousands of banks. I mean, at currently about maybe 1,000 banks, you know, so you could have 1,000 equivalent to a central bank, even at current levels of something like 1,000 central banks that are completely free market, that are completely independent of government control, none of whom can change the money supply, and all they can do is clear payments for clients in a free market, free competitive market for banks, in which, you know, if any of these banks does something that you don't like, you're free to go and move on to any other one. So if you do this, if you think of Bitcoin in that sense, that's when Bitcoin is really powerful. Who cares about PayPal or Visa? We're here to compete with the Federal Reserve, with the IMF, with the Bank of International Settlement, and with the European Union. And frankly, perhaps, you know, perhaps I wasn't exactly correct to say that you'd have to be stupid to believe those ideas. You could also be motivated about it. In fact, you know, if I were a central banker, perhaps the most effective line of attack against Bitcoin to prevent it from playing that role that competes with central banks, that could take away monetary policy from the hands of banks if people move towards using Bitcoin. The most effective way to do though so would be to increase the capacity or increase the block size of Bitcoin in order to continue to hard fork it in order to make people stop thinking that it, the policy is immutable. You know, introduce a change in the hard and in the hard and the block size, and then move from the block size towards, let's say, well, you know, we need to increase the money supply, because then we get Keynesians arguing for things like that. So that's what needs disruption. And that's what Bitcoin can disrupt, because it could replace that one central bank with all that ability to create money and inflate the money supply and all of that, and determine who gets to have money and who gets to send it. You could replace that with an open free market network of thousands of banks, none of whom can affect the money supply, none of whom can tell you can send your money or not, and all of whom are subject to free market competition.
Now, if you're really going to take the Fed on institutionally, naturally, you're going to be subjected to a demonization campaign. Bitcoin, they've already attempted to demonize it. Every time they turn around, they're saying something negative about it, or they're trying to suggest that it's somehow shady, you know, that the dregs of society use it. And in fact, that has been an unfortunately very successful campaign, because for a lot of people who don't know the ins and outs of Bitcoin, what they know is they've read that people who are underhanded and up to no good and criminals are using it. And in fact, it's gotten to the point where you even have to address this as one of the questions about Bitcoin in Chapter 10 of your book. So can we dispense with this quickly?
First of all, let me just say I am not going to take on the Federal Reserve myself, just to make it clear to all of your listeners. Right. You know, target all of your ire at the software, not at me. I didn't make the software, and I'm not taking it. I'm just an economist who's analyzing how this is working out. The way that I see it, yeah, Bitcoin is really up against the Federal Reserve, and of course, the disinformation and the attacks are going to come, but fundamentally, they do not matter. They cannot matter, because software is incapable of succumbing to propaganda. And I'll explain why in terms of just the economic incentives of the system. Fundamentally, you know, the way that I like to think about it is this is hard money, and hard money will kill soft money. It doesn't matter how much the Ecuadorian government told people that the U.S. dollar is bad and you shouldn't own U.S. dollars, and only the bad speculators and evil bankers are holding U.S. dollars in order to destroy our currency. Eventually, the Ecuadorian currency collapsed, and the U.S. dollar is now the currency of Ecuador. So this is a very similar system. You know, you have an inferior currency fighting up against a better one. And the idea that, you know, political propaganda or news is going to alter the economic reality of fast inflation versus slow inflation, I think is wishful thinking. It might delay things. It might fool some people here or there, but fundamentally, economic reality will assert itself. Actually, if you want to use a better example, I mean, some of the examples that I mentioned in my book of the ancient forms of money and what happens when people find, you know, when people come from civilizations that have more advanced, harder forms of money. It's not optional whether your island that uses seashells is going to decide whether they want to move towards using gold or not. You know, it didn't matter if the government of one of these islands made a propaganda against gold, saying using gold money is bad. Stick to the seashells. Seashells are done as money because their supply is just going to continue to increase much more easily than gold's supply, and so its value is going to continue to drop next to gold. And people will eventually realize this. People act out of their own economic self-interest, regardless of what they tell you and regardless of what they'll say. People eventually will realize that if they hold seashells, the value of their money is going to be lost, whereas if they hold gold, the value of their money will be preserved. And that's why seashells are doomed. And I think we have something similar here. It's so, you know, this is just economic reality that's going to assert itself whether people like it or not. Now, in terms of whether it is used by criminals, I mean, I think what I argue in my book is that Bitcoin can be used for victimless crimes, but it would be extremely stupid to use it for things that involve actual victims. And, you know, obviously, as a libertarian, I don't think there is such a thing as a victimless crime. But yes, Bitcoin has been used a lot for people buying drugs online or things like that. But, you know, if you're going to commit a crime and you're going to pay somebody to commit that crime, the last thing you want is to have a permanent record distributed over thousands of people listing that transaction. You know, it's you'll never know what kind of technology emerges over time that can identify who this address belongs to or who that address belongs to, and then somebody will be able to link them to one another, and then 5 years later, somebody is able to find out that you were the one who committed the crime. So generally, you know, I always say to all the criminals, stick to the international criminal currency of choice, the US dollar, because it's far better for all criminal needs to just use cash bills than to try and use Bitcoin, which leaves a permanent record. Lots of people have used it, but you know, people forget that a lot of the criminals that have gotten caught using Bitcoin were specifically caught because of using Bitcoin. And I think this meme that has spread around of Bitcoin as being good for dark currency and for drugs, it's extremely, extremely misguided, and it's extremely dangerous, because a lot of people have ruined their lives because they got this idea that, you know, Bitcoin is, you know, safe, anonymous, dark digital currency on the internet. It isn't. It leaves a record permanently distributed over thousands of computers all over the world. Definitely not what you want to do if you're committing a crime. Now, granted, there are ways of hiding your tracks, but they're extremely difficult because there are also ways of trying to track you down. So I would definitely not recommend that it be used for crime. And I think over time, what has happened, particularly over the last 2-3 years, is that the people using Bitcoin have stopped using them for these sorts of things. It's much less likely. Far fewer people use it as a percentage in terms of the users. I think far fewer people use it for drugs or for crime or for any of that stuff, because it's just not a good thing to do to have it on a permanent record.
All right. Before I do want to get into a couple more economic merits of Bitcoin, but as long as we're on some of the alleged demerits, one thing we've read about in the paper a lot is that Bitcoin mining consumes a lot of power. And we see a lot of left progressives saying that it's therefore a complete social waste. I mean, it's producing something we don't even need, because, of course, governments are already giving us all the good money we could ask for. But then they're taking all this power and just dissipating it for no good reason. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, the shorter answer is that the only measure of whether electricity is wasted or not is the person who's spending their money on it. So all of the people moaning about Bitcoin wasting too much electricity, you know, they travel and they go on vacations and they have TVs in their homes and they get into cars for going on trips. And these things waste a lot of electricity. So who's to decide what deserves to be to waste electricity on or not? It's a completely silly idea that you could have somebody in a position of authority deciding whether this is wasteful or not. The only real test is, are people willing to pay for it or not? So the fact that people are paying for Bitcoin, regardless of why they're paying for it, is all that you need to know. People are paying for others to produce this Bitcoin thing, and they're paying, and those others are taking the money and they're producing it. So it's a market transaction like all others, and the fact that it spends electricity is no different from any activity that spends electricity. But now, getting into it in more detail, the reality is, I think Bitcoin consumes a lot of electricity, and it will continue to consume more and more electricity, and I think that is a good thing. The notion that, you know, spending electricity is bad is one of the most evil, one of the most mendacious and despicable ideas that have been spread over the last few decades. Nothing could be more anti-progress than the idea that we should aim to reduce our electricity consumption or our energy consumption. You will reduce your energy consumption when you're dead. It will go down to zero. And as long as you're alive, the more energy you consume, the better off your life is. You look around the world, your quality of life is highly correlated to the amount of energy that people spend. Happiness is also highly correlated to that. Why? Because electricity makes our life good. Electricity, also going back to the issue of scarcity, you know, it's not like energy is scarce. There's no limit to how much energy we have. You know, the sun on its own hits the earth with hundreds of times of all the energy that we consume daily. The fossil fuels that exist underground contain enormous quantities of energy, and you know, all kinds of different energy sources are out there for us to utilize. The limit again is how much we utilize them, and there's nothing wrong with utilizing them because it makes our life better. So, you know, you could make the same idiotic argument against cars, and you could say, well, you know, horses didn't consume a lot of energy, and we lived in societies fine. We were doing fine with horses. Why do we need all these thousands of or these millions of cars all over the world spending all that much energy? No, cars spend more energy than horses, and that's why it's a good thing. Building a modern house consumes much more energy than building a little tent or a teepee or whatever, and that's a good thing. That's why your house can withstand the winter. We, as humans, our progress is dependent on spending energy on doing things that make life better for us. And so, for me, I can't think of anything better to do with electricity than replacing central banks. And I think the market is clearly agreeing with me, because the amount of money that people are spending on it tells you that there is demand for this thing, regardless of what progressives want to think about how wonderful their government money is. You know, they're free to keep using their idiotic 19th century technology of manual monetary policy if they want to. But some of us have moved on to the 21st century, and we'd like to use automated electricity-generated monetary policy that cannot be corrupted by human beings. So I cannot think of anything more valuable in the world than to take money out of the hands of government. And I think you would probably agree with me. If we could do that, we would not have wars. We would not have governments being able to carry out genocides. We would not have hyperinflations. I mean, if we only, the entire world, had one episode of Venezuelan hyperinflation once a century, and moving to Bitcoin allowed us to save that one episode, it would be totally worth all of the electricity that it spends, no matter how much electricity it spends. I mean, the human suffering that has happened because of having money being controlled by governments, which means it's being controlled by individuals who are self-interested, is untold. It's unimaginable. You know, two world wars were highly related to the fact that governments could print money and finance themselves. There's a reason war, and I discussed this in my book, there's a reason the two world wars did not happen in the 19th century under the gold standard. They only happened after the gold standard was abandoned, because before that, when money was gold and governments couldn't print gold, if they fought wars, they were very, very careful about their resources, because they couldn't just keep financing themselves. As soon as they ran out of gold, the war was over. Or as soon as one of them began to realize they're beginning to run out, or as soon as, even, you know, even as soon as the tide started shifting a little bit in favor of one of the parties, the other one would immediately want to seek a negotiation. That's why conflicts in the 19th century were much shorter, because government financing was much more restricted. And governments that went about and fought wars wantonly, like 20th century governments, in the 18th and 19th century, they would just simply go bankrupt very quickly. So it might be the case that Bitcoin will one day end up consuming exactly half of all of the electricity that is produced in the world. And frankly, good. You know, if that's the price that we have to pay to make sure that we don't have fiat money, we don't have government money, we don't have another Iraq war, we don't have another Zimbabwe and Venezuelan hyperinflation, I would be more than glad to pay it. I mean, I look at half of the things that I spend my electricity on, and I'm quite happy to. None of them is as important as that. I don't need to be watching TV. I don't need to travel most of the trips that I go on. Most of my electricity consumption is nowhere near as important to me as getting rid of government control of money.
Well, with that, I think we're going to call it a day. I want to urge people to check out the Bitcoin Standard, the decentralized alternative to central banking, because it's great material on Bitcoin, but also great material on money, monetary theory, the history of money, where we've gone wrong with it. And that discussion then culminates in your discussion of Bitcoin. So it all fits in very nicely. There's also there's further discussion of the economic merits of Bitcoin in terms of the functions that it can serve. For example, it we didn't get to the idea of being a global unit of account and performing the role that gold used to perform in terms of international settlements. There's a lot of really interesting pioneering stuff in this book, and it's written in a way that's quite absorbing, and you won't feel like it's overly technical. It really is just written for the intelligent layman, which is what's been needed for some time, somebody who really, really gets both the economics in general, not just the economics of Bitcoin, but economics in general, monetary economics. This is a very rare thing in our day and age. And then also be able to take that and apply it to an informed discussion of Bitcoin. Well, this is like a unicorn, folks, so grab it. The Bitcoin Standard, the Decentralized Alternative to Central Banking. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1171. Saif, is there a website you'd like to direct people to in addition to that?
I'm usually most active on Twitter. Saifuddin is my handle, which is just my first name. And there's also my website, which contains contact information and all that, saifuddin.com. So just find the spelling of my name and you'll be able to find me anywhere you look on the internet. And thank you so much, Tom. It really means a lot to me what you just said. I'm extremely glad that you like the book.
Well, my pleasure, and I will spell it for them. It's SAIFEDEAN. Now go follow him. And again, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Tom. Have a good day.
All right, folks, before I let you go today, remember we did an episode not too long ago with our friend Gret Glier, who created the DonorSee app, which is just an amazing, wonderful revolution in philanthropy. It's just an outstanding thing. And I was saying that everybody who joined me in making a $1,000 investment in this extremely exciting and just wonderful app that he's developed that's done so much good all over the world already, that I would throw in an extra bonus. And I've got somebody who has a different bonus in mind, and I absolutely agree with it, and I'm glad to do it, and that's Max Paderewski. He has asked if I could say just a brief word to you about his services as a personal injury attorney. He's a libertarian and a longtime Tom Woods fan from the Peter Schiff Show guest host days. And he says he represents clients in personal injury, wrongful death, and medical malpractice cases in Virginia, Washington, D.C., and Maryland. And he will give a free consultation to any Tom Woods Show listener when you mention my name. You can contact him at his website, maxforyourcase.com. So check out Max, good guy, helped out Gret Glier with DonorSee, and he's going to give you a free consultation if you need it. So check him out at maxforyourcase.com, and I'll see you guys tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.